Christopher Michael Day, and I live at 1565 Deerhurst Lane. That's in Rochester Hills, Michigan, 48063.
And what your major is and what year you're in?
Well, right now I'm a sophomore, and I'm majoring in business law and justice, morality, and constitutional democracy. It's a dual major.
So you eventually want to be a lawyer?
Well, right now, yeah. I was in debate in high school, so I think that sparked my interest in law. And I just don't want to go the mathematical route with engineering or something. So as of now, I do want to go to law school.
If you could tell me what questions you were particularly interested in, and maybe we could start by focusing on those.
Well, the one about describe the kind of life you'd like to have once you graduated from college, and attaining the goals and the type of nirvana. Those two questions were kind of related and stuck out in my mind.
Okay. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? And what is your long-range goal?
Well, long-range goal is, if I could have it the way I want, my goal is to get that nirvana type of thing, to be happy, to be content. Content's the secret word, I think. I mean, I'd like to live like in New England, wife, children, doing something that's fun, but yet gives me enough finances that I don't have to worry about money. Money isn't a problem. It's kind of like a fairy tale type of thing, I suppose, but that's what I'd like to get if I could.
But in terms of a vocation, what does that mean as you see it?
Well, right now, law interests me a lot. If I could get a occupation in law or something that related that would make me happy, that would be just fine. You know, the idea of law school scares me, though.
Do you see this as a selfish goal? I mean, how do you compare yourself to the collegians of the 1960s who were demonstrating for civil rights, who were protesting against the war in Vietnam, who seemed to be concerned with dramatic causes outside of themselves? How do you compare to that generation? How do your peers compare to that?
So it's more of the generation as opposed to the individual?
Either one. Answer first comparing yourself to individuals of that type, and then speak for the people that you know.
Not growing up in the 60s, it's just, I don't understand why no one's protesting. Maybe there isn't, because there isn't anything major going on, perhaps. But I think maybe akin to some of the protests, I guess we should be protesting as youth, protesting against Grenada or similar things to that. I don't know. I personally don't feel selfish. I think the desire to have a productive and happy life is a privilege, a right, in fact, for everyone. And to pursue that, the right of happiness, is not selfish at all. You know, as a group, as a whole generation, I suppose. I think, I don't know if it's selfish, but I think everyone this generation seems a little more individual-oriented on their own goals as opposed to the goals of a nation, maybe, or the goals of their whole generation. It's more what this person wants to do.
Well, the journalists have called this age a mercenary one, an age of acquisition. They've labeled people as being yuppies. They've called it the me generation. There's a lot of negative criticism about young people in this day and age. Do you think that's fair? Do you think there's any credibility? Are they any more selfish than any other generation, any other set of 19-year-old kids?
I don't know. I think anyone looking back at another generation, just as, of course, I'm only a sophomore, only 20 years old, but I think anyone looking back over the years would think this generation seems a little more selfish to me or something. Not wanting to admit their own maybe selfishness or individuality. But I think some of it has some bearing, some of the criticism by reporters. I have to admit, like, one of my goals coming to college was, well, when I graduate, I'd like to have, by age 30, my first million. And now that isn't one of my goals. Now I see it's empty. But I think that high school and what I learned in high school and what I've implanted from my environment implanted that idea in me, that is good.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What in your high school environment and the contact that you had with I presume your mother and father caused you to have that as an idea, as a goal.
I think all parents, one time or another, say, you've got to work real hard to get good grades so you can go to college, so you can get a good job. And then you have to ask yourself and judge for yourself, what is a good job? Is it one that makes a lot of money? Is it one that makes you happy? I don't think you have to go to a college necessarily to find a job that makes you happy. So I think it was more financially oriented. If you want to support a family, if you want to be financially well off, you've got to study hard. So all through high school, your goal is, I'm studying hard so that I can go to college so I can make money. And I think that gets that individual approach. You've got to work hard for yourself so that you'll be successful.
Well, you can put a certain amount of emphasis on the money, and then you can put a certain amount of emphasis on the job itself, the extent to which you like a given vocation. And it seems as though, at least earlier, you were putting a greater emphasis on the material standard that you could attain, rather than on what the job might do to you on a personal level. Is it fair to say that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And I think coming up to school, not so much in the classes, but I think just living here, being a part, having, you know, thrown into this new environment, I think everyone learns a lot about themselves. And I think I learned that money really isn't all that important.
Well, how have you learned that? Has it been through professors? Has it been talking to foreign students who have been basically poor? What has caused your attitude to change?
Interactions with people. My girlfriend, I've learned a lot. Just, you know, learning about each other, you learn a lot about yourself. And I had a professor for a social science class. I really don't like social science class, but this one, he had some things that made you think about yourself. And
what kind of class?
It was Cultures in Crisis, but it dealt with in Africa and how the English, the white people are coming in, and they're trying to impress their own beliefs upon the Africans, when in fact the Africans are happy now and they don't want any of this stuff, but the Americans or the Englishmen are trying to impress their beliefs on them to rationalize why they like it, you know, their quest for money or their quest for this and that. They want to rationalize it and make, you know, you guys aren't allowed to have fun, you know, on your own doing this primitive stuff. You've got to do it our way, to rationalize themselves. And then I put a lot of thought into that. And it actually, I think it had some relevance to our society itself.
Did it have relevance to you as an individual?
I think so. Although he even said, you guys won't want to admit it, because it's true. If you were to admit that about yourself, then you're saying, well, I'm not as good as I'd like to be. I'm admitting that I'm bad, or not as good. I'm manipulated by my society, by the environment. I'm not what I am so much.
Aren't we all manipulated by our society? Aren't we all products of this society?
Oh, definitely. But I think as a moral whole, I think certain societies will impress different values upon someone. And I think after going through this class, that I think the America, that, you know, it's a great country, but I think it impresses some more negative values. This whole idea of materialism, the whole concept of doing this or that in, you know, America, as opposed to, you know, in Africa, where they're happy planting corn, you know, it's, or whatever.
What were the values that were impressed on you from your parents?
Well, I don't think my parents are materialistic when I said that, but I think they imposed it on me inadvertently. You know, they want me to be the best I can be. And I think as a youth, that was implied, I implied that as being monetarily successful. And
may I ask what your father does?
He works consumer relations for General Motors. And he makes a hefty salary, I'd say.
And your mother?
She works for cancer research at Wayne State, and she doesn't really like her job, and the only reason why she's working it is for the money to help put me through school and my brother, and to keep the household running smoothly.
So you have one brother, no sisters?
Correct.
Well, so your mother is clearly making a sacrifice.
Yes, she does not enjoy her job at all.
Does your father enjoy his job?
Yes. At least from what I've gathered and from what I've taken in. I've never actually said, Dad, do you really like your job? But from his attitudes and from the way he comes home, and he talks favorably about it. Sometimes a lot of our family have told my mother, well, why don't you just quit? And she says, well, I can't, because we need the money, you know. And that bothers me a little bit. I'd be willing to make sacrifices to make my mom happy.
Well, all right. I have to reach over here once. All right, so you had this set of conceptions when you left high school about where you wanted to go, the general material standard you wanted to attain. You came here, and some of those ideas have changed. Can you talk a little bit about the shift of just going from high school to this huge university where there must have been at least 10,000 freshmen, and there you are, you're thrown into a room with a person you probably don't even know, and Brody, whatever it is.
Brody.
Just give me a description of that, how you adjusted to that, if you did adjust. Some people don't seem to adjust.
It is a different situation. And I'm sure everyone's heard the phrase that 50% of all the education you get at college isn't in the classroom. It's just learning about yourself and how to interact with people. And in high school, you're within this rigid, all these little cliques, the jocks, the brains, the this and that. And then you come up to college and that's just, it's shattered. And you've got to start from scratch. And I think I had maybe an advantage. Now I think back, maybe it was a disadvantage. But I roomed with someone that I knew back in high school. And so I think I was limited to meeting a lot of people as opposed to having a new roommate, because the two new individuals are together. They have to go out and they have to meet new people. They've got to start all over. Whereas I already had a base to work from. And I think that maybe in the long run hurt me a little bit. I think most people learn more their first year of college than they do about interacting with people than they do their whole years of high school.
Can you describe one or more experiences which you may have had in which you learned something?
Actually,
you're putting this on a general level. I will, throughout this interview, try to nail you down to specifics. Mm-hmm. Because I know the abstract level of this. Mm-hmm. What interesting. I know it's difficult to talk about some of these things. Sure, anything like that. It's running now.
Okay. Well, as I said before, I roomed with someone I knew back in high school. In fact, it was pretty much my best friend. And we definitely, at the end of the year, we definitely didn't have the same relationship. We didn't get along very well towards the middle. I think it had to do with the winter, but I think also that we started grading on each other. I think you come up to college and it breaks down barriers, and you learn people the way they really are. For example, back in high school, I only saw my roommate at certain intervals, you know, maybe at school and sometimes after school, but never actually living with him, spending almost like 24 hours except for classes with him. And so I liked what I knew in high school, but when you came up to college, it's something different, and he's just not someone you'll get along with. And I can think of a lot of instances where we haven't gotten along.
Can you give me one? I mean, did he drop his dirty laundry in the middle of the floor? Did he have three women? And I don't know. Whatever.
Well, he always wanted to watch a particular TV show. And you can go to the TV lounge, you can go anywhere, but he wanted to watch it in the room. And I really don't like to study anywhere else but the room. And I asked him, you know, could I please study here and you watch it somewhere else? And he said, no, I want to watch it here. And he insisted on watching here, and he did. And so I moved, and I wasn't happy about moving, you know, out out into the hall or into the study lounge, and I studied there. And he insists that type of thing. And also, you know, there's only one stereo between two of you. And when you have different, slightly different musical tastes, you get tired of hearing maybe the same tape over and over, if you get my drift. And when I ask him, could you please play something else, or could you play this or that? And he say, no, it's my recorder. It's my stereo. So, no, we can't. And then, you know, I felt kind of some anger toward him, because here I is, he's using my refrigerator, or he's using my word processor, and I let him use it whenever he wants. I sometimes even sacrifice my time to do it, and here he won't let me listen to any kind of the music I like. And you start getting these little differences, and it reached this large climax, I'd say sometime around March, where we were just like extremely angry at each other, almost yelling at each other. When finally we both broke down and said, we've got to straighten this out. We've still got like 5-6 months left, or whatever it was, 2-3. And so we sat down, we actually just talked, we told all of our feelings, got them all out, and we managed to survive the last 3 months. But I have to tell you, I think I've talked to him maybe a total of 3 times, 4 times since then. And he used to be my best friend. It's... things have changed. But I think it's for the better.
Do you think this is typical of a lot of relationships that exist in freshman dorms?
I think in the situation where I was, I think you take someone that you were already good friends with, room with them, you learn about him in a whole new different sense. And I think it can go either way. I think you can get either closer, or I think it can break off like it did. And I've seen it happen. I've seen friends that that the same situations has happened.
Was it difficult in this instance for you to confront your roommate with some of these truths, like, why don't you use headphones instead of blasting your stereo? I mean, basic considerations like that?
Yeah, it was difficult to approach, just because I felt I was right and it wasn't my responsibility to approach him first. And I resorted to just talking to other people on the floor, you know, just bitching about him behind them, you know, saying, I've got this complaint, this complaint, this complaint. What do you think I should do? And they said, well, I don't know. It seems like it's his problem. And of course, he would give his side to someone else. And they say, well, it sounds like it's my problem. And I remember wanting to talk to him. I wanted to get it straightened out, get it all worked up. But it's kind of tough to say something to a person you're very mad at and angry with, especially someone that you used to be kind of close to. I couldn't just approach him and say, listen, Bill, I'm tired of this music you're playing. I really can't stand it. I asked you before to turn it off, and you just don't. You just disregard me. You insist on playing it loud when I go to bed early, or whatsoever, you know, whatever the situation. And I think it's rude. And I give you that courtesy. Why don't you give it to me? And then, of course, then his side came out. He had a lot of things to say. Well, if you go to bed early a certain day, I mean, what am I supposed to do? I mean, I want to do this or that. Don't you have a right to sleep? Well, don't I have a right to do this or that too? And, you know, it worked out. In the end, it worked out. But it's different looking back now, spending 9 years with someone and then having it break off, and I'm not really even thinking twice about it. I've made new friends, and that you know initially, without the barriers in high school, you know them well.
Okay, if you could now contrast that kind of environment with the fraternity environment, its pros and cons.
The pros and cons of fraternity life.
But you changed from that freshman dorm to this. What do you like about this, which is better? I will not play this back for any of your fraternity brothers, incidentally, so.
I think fraternities are some of the greatest things and opportunities you can have at college. I really do. Some of the reasons, well, there are so many people that there's always someone that has your same interests. And I rushed with another particular friend of mine that we were really close, and we ended up rushing the same fraternity and pledging, and so we're brothers now. But you can count on a friend for a certain thing, and you can count on a brother for even more. That's a quote, and it really has some bearing, because you learn a lot about people as you go through your pledgeship. You learn about your pledge brothers really close, and you actually find it's just a structured way of finding friendships and bonds. It's just structured, and so it works out. It works out more solidly, and it gives you goals to work for. It gives you experience, things to learn for your future.
Can you briefly describe the rushing process? How many people wanted to get into this fraternity? How many were accepted, and what you had to go through? I know that a certain amount of it is secret, mm-hmm. the initiation.
Well, I'd say about just this term, about 100 different people came through our doors, meeting as many people as they could and seeing if they liked being here, if they felt comfortable, if they wanted to be friends and share the same goals, and of that, about 17 have actually joined up. And others, I'd say maybe 50% of the others went to other fraternities and such. Because I think there's like a fraternity for everyone.
They would be voted on. How does that work?
They're voted after discussion. It's called hash. After you talk about, will this person, have a positive fraternal experience, or will he one drop from the program, or will he two? Will he be a negative factor on our goals, our positive attitudes, our community service? Will he participate in this community services that we do? Will he do this? And does he have the grades that he wouldn't be sacrificing any more of his academics by coming here? What I'm saying is, if you have academics come first, always come first. And if you have a 1.5 right now grade point average, there's no way you would get a bid just because we believe academics come first. And it is, being in a fraternity takes a lot of time. And if already you don't seem to have enough time for studies, then it's not for you. And then the vote's made, and by unanimous vote, that person will get an invitation to join.
If there's one dissenting vote, he's excluded?
Not necessarily. If certain people can't convince the dissenting individual, it doesn't usually work with just one person that way. It usually works with large amounts, because after the discussion, people share the same views. Everything's out in the open, and there really isn't any one person saying, "Well, I know all you guys don't think he wouldn't fit in, but I think he would." That rarely, really happens.
Of course, there is a group dynamic there, mm-hmm. where if you have these 10 most important people of the fraternity saying that this person should come in, then becomes difficult for anyone to dissent.
Granted, I think that would be in any situation, any kind of club, group, or organization. We like to think every brother's opinions is valued equally, in fact. Our president, although he has the authority, when actually in the good of the fraternity, when it's a group decision, his judgment carries as much weight as everyone else's. Every brother has an equal say. Although maybe people might be influenced more just because he is the president, but in on paper, everything's equal.
I know some fraternities are well known for attracting certain types of students. There's a fraternity for jocks, a fraternity for blacks, a fraternity for this, for that, and the other thing. How would you characterize this fraternity?
I think almost every fraternity wants to be diverse. They say, we've got just the widest range of people. And I don't like to go along with that flow. But when I say I think we're one of the most diverse houses on campus, I think we are. I think we have our athletes. And on the other side, we've got our scholars. We've got this year we took the football championship, the volleyball championship. Now on the other hand, we've got individuals in Order of Omega, Honor Society, and this and that. And there aren't many fraternities that have that wide range. of scholastics or the arts or athletics, whatever it is. I think we're probably one of the most diverse houses on campus, and I've heard that from outsiders, from other fraternities and from sororities.
What do the other fraternities and sororities, when they speak of this fraternity, do they label it in any way?
A particular label? You mean a stereotype, maybe?
Yeah.
No, I think a lot of fraternities could be stereotyped.
Phi Beta Kappa. I mean,
okay.
That has a reputation for attracting the intellectuals, right?
Or the isn't Phi Beta Kappa more of a honor society?
That's an honor society, yeah. But I don't know whether that originally.
Well, I don't know. Is it okay for me to name names?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I think Theta Chi, without a doubt, I think everyone labels that as the big athletic fraternity. And then there's fraternities like Pi Caps and Sigma Nu, which are, I think, are very diverse too, that you can't stereotype them. They have a wide range of people. And I think that's where we would fit, I think, into that mold of diverse, of well-rounded in every aspect.
How about the criticism that some people who don't belong to fraternities level at the fraternities? They say that they become ingrown, that they're very protective, they're very elitist, all of the standard labels which you sometimes hear.
I found that everyone that were to say that those type of things have never actually experienced the Greek system. My friend and I that we rushed with, we thought it was elitist. We thought this and that, and the only reason why we came that Sunday night for rush was because we were hungry and we needed food, and food wasn't being served in the dorms, so we came for free food. And that, sure enough, that week we just ended up rushing seriously, and we accepted a bid and everything. I think the most annoying things that non-Greeks might say about fraternity men are that you're buying your friends, and you become elitist. You don't talk to anyone else, or this and that. If you're not Greek, then you might as well not even bother coming near this person because he won't talk to you because he's a fraternity guy, or this and that. It's really kind of silly. It might be true for certain. Maybe it's possible. Maybe he was blown off by a fraternity guy, just one guy. But that could have happened with a non-fraternity guy, if you know what I mean. And I think that just because that person might be wearing letters or something, then they get a negative idea of the entire Greek system. And another, about buying your friends, you know, you pay so much money a term to be in a fraternity, and you're like buying your friends, when really that's not the case at all. It's you've got the friends. The friends are there. No matter what, you've got those friends. The only reason why you're paying money is for the social budget. Just like you would go to a party and pay $5 for to drink all the beer you like, that's what you do, only you're buying it ahead of time, is the beer, the food, or this and that, party favors. It's an organization, it's a social fraternity, and the money that goes into it is promoting the social aspect of it. You've already got the friends. You're not going to lose the friends.
Fraternities certainly have a reputation, or some of them, for throwing wild parties. But I don't know whether those parties are any more wild than what goes on in some of the dorms.
I think, I think there are some houses that could be labeled as wild party fraternities, but I don't know firsthand, but I because I've never experienced it. But from what I gather, there are some, fraternities that do have wild parties out of hand. And I would think those are a little bit rowdier than dorm parties. I think the biggest difference that maybe why you might label it, or someone might label it, a wild party, is because they're so much larger. You're not in a dorm room, you're in a large hall or a large chapter room, which is about four or five times as big as a dorm room, and you've got specific guest lists, you have specific invitations going out, just like you do in the dorm. But because everyone's organized in the Greek system. It's like this fraternity, this sorority. You can invite an entire sorority and still have, you know, they will all be invited, as opposed to inviting invitations to each person. Well, you invite the entire sorority and they're all invited. And so that's how the parties can get big. And I think that's the only way it really gets labeled as wild. And because also there's no resident assistants or this and that. But I think the Greek system, it might even be more responsible.
This question of your perception of your intelligence in high school, how that perception changes when you suddenly find yourself in competition with kids who, many of whom were valedictorians. In other words, the level of competition is raised. Now, how did you handle that?
It was, to be perfectly honest, in high school, I really didn't, it wasn't very challenging for me. So I never really did any of the homework, and I still maintained a halfway decent grade point. And when I came up here, I did have to do the homework, and I kept the same grade point. So I did feel it in that way. I actually had to put in some work into the classes to get exactly where I was getting out of high school. And it's plainly evident, the competition. Everything's on a curve. So in effect, in some of my classes, my grade was actually lower just because everyone's class average was better. I've got, I think, a class average of 91%. And in most classes, that would be a 4 point. Instead, because everyone got about a 90% or so, it was lowered down, so it was only a 3.5, you know. And that's it's kind of disappointing. Where was I?
We're talking about
competition.
Grades. So you were not challenged in high school?
No, not a bit.
But up here, you must have an awareness that there are many people who are as smart, if not smarter, than yourself. Or do you have that awareness?
I do. In fact, one of my best friends, the friend I rushed with, is he's on a full scholarship, the Distinguished Alumni Scholarship. That's a full ride plus $300 spending money a term. And that's because he's just brilliant. He's studying in Germany a full year now on the scholarship. And
what's he majoring in?
A dual major, German and mechanical engineering. Yeah, and so I kind of pale beneath that, or at least I feel like I do. And you can easily feel the competition. It actually gives me a challenge now. It gives me some reasons to try. But I think about the intelligence part, that kind of relates to after school too, is I think there are some people that are getting better grades that aren't necessarily more intelligent. And that's just because maybe they put more time into studying or don't have any extracurricular activities, let's say, like I do. I've got, you know, I've been holding a job. Last term I held 2. I'm in the fraternity. I hold the position of secretary. I do this, I do that. And I know a few people that are getting 4 points, but spend all their time in the room studying. And I couldn't live my life like that just for a grade. So it doesn't bother me that some people are getting better grades, but it bothers me thinking that when I graduate from college, that these people might be getting taking a position away from me that I think I could have been qualified for. You know, I wish intelligence just could be registered. Here's my intelligence, and then look at this is the type of person he is. Because I definitely don't think some people are more qualified than me just because they have a better grade point. I think that bothers me a little bit. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do know what you're saying. Well, it doesn't bother you to the point that you are willing to give up all of these outside activities and concentrate only on your grades.
Oh, not at all. I think planning for your future is one thing. I think living life now is another, too. They're like the extremes. I mean, if you plan strictly for your future, shut yourself in your room, get all 4 points, and not really do anything else is an extreme. And also just hedonistically living, not caring about your future is another. And I don't want to be either of those extremes. I want to be nicely in between. I want to enjoy my life, myself, my years in college like I am, and yet still do pretty well in school, which I believe I'm doing.
You said you held down some jobs. What were they?
I worked as a debate judge for high school students at East Lansing High School and for tournaments throughout the state. And that, I don't know if you know anything about scholastic debate, but the two sides will present their situation, and then you have to judge how well they were argued and give your points. And that was a fun job. The hours were limited.
You got paid for that?
Yeah, $12.50 a round, which was kind of nice. And then I worked at quality dairy across the street making minimum wage. And that was strictly for the money, and I didn't enjoy that time at all.
Did you learn anything from that job?
From quality dairy? I learned that I don't like that type of work for that little money. See, I really didn't need money. It was to get through school, to pay for my education. And so I had no choice but to get a job. And I couldn't, going to the extreme, planning for your future, I was miserable there. I saw all the employees almost getting wrung out. For $3.35 an hour, you got to do this amount of work. You know, whereas I could go for work 1 hour debate and make $12.50. I mean, there's a big difference there. Or work at McDonald's for, you know, 2 hours and make double that just because they pay more. And the quality of work wasn't proportional to the wage. And not that I'm materialistic, not that I wanted to buy things, which I may be, but I had to think about school and paying for school. And that's what the important thing was at the time.
This is a blue-collar town.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah, so. It is. And that, I think that really bothered me, too. I saw a lot of people that were almost career quality dairy. And I saw them, to be honest, wasting their lives. I know they could get a better job. I know that I see them work incredibly hard. I mean, just admirably. And they're making, what, $4 an hour? Big deal. I worked as a manager at McDonald's for 3 years, made, you know, $5.25 an hour. And that, you know, that was fun work. And I see these people working just as hard. And maybe they didn't have the education or whatever. But I think they're worth more than that. I saw them undervalued, and that really bothered me.
Where did you work at McDonald's? In high school?
In high school. Yeah, in Rochester. I worked, let's say, it was pretty much my first real job. I turned 16. My dad said, time to work. And I said, great, I'd like some spending money. I have to save for school. Sure. So I worked at McDonald's for a year, and then I turned 18, and I was asked by the management to be a manager. And I said, great. One, it gave me full-time work as opposed to what I was working for, which was more flexible. And two, it paid more. And three, I thought it would look pretty good on a resume for my future. You know, signing up, applying for my final career, I think it would look decent that I was management at so young. And I really did enjoy the job. It was really fun. And it helped me. I didn't have to work as many hours up here just because I made enough money in the summer. But then towards the end, new management, all the old management except myself was fired. And
why?
Because the store, they believed the store wasn't being run properly. The owner thought a lot of things could be changed. And obviously thought I was good enough that I could stay on, so I did. And
As manager.
And I was flattered. I was training managers after that. I had a lot of responsibilities, but that's when it started getting less fun and became more of, I think I became undervalued. I was getting paid $5.25 to train, to manage the store, a $1 million operation, which in fact it was, and to train managers that in the long run were going to make more money than me. Because I was going to school, I would only make $5.25 an hour, whereas these gentlemen that I was training were going to make $300, $400 a week. And that bothered me. Christmas bonus. I remember Christmas bonus came around. I got what all the other employees got, this little cheap headphone radio. And all the managers that I just trained, that same month I trained them, they had $50 bonuses, $100 bonuses. And that really kind of upset me.
Well, it seems as if you've had some experiences where you have seen the inequity of the society, the haves and the have-nots.
I should put a sign on my door, I suppose.
That's okay. Anyway, so there's this disparity, which you've witnessed at Quality Dairy to a certain extent at McDonald's and maybe at some other types of jobs. Do you think about that in terms of this particular society as opposed to one which is more socialized, as opposed to Scandinavia, where there is not a tremendous disparity between the rich and the poor?
I definitely like the setup here, okay? And from what I know about Sweden and how, you know, it's working great over there, but I think it, it, it I think that type of system stifles people, or not necessarily stifles people, but prevents them from being all they can be. And the only problem in this society, I think, is being more aware. I think if more individuals were aware that they are not getting paid what they're worth, or not getting treated the way they should be, they should, you know, stand up for it, do what they can. You know, when unions were really big, I think, you know, way back when, I don't know, it was about 60 years ago that Quality Dairy was formed, there's a point where they attempted to unionize, and it was voted down at the time. And I know for a fact the owner is very stringently keeping unions out. He will not let one in. And he's keeping he runs a very tight business, but I think he's keeping all of his employees somewhat maybe in the dark to prevent them from wanting that union or from wanting to ask for more.
Are we only talking about a question of awareness here? I mean, all we have to do is drive down to Detroit, to the ghettos, or Chicago. Or are we talking about a society which only gives real opportunity to a rather small number?
I think everyone has an opportunity.
Is it equal?
No, I don't think it's absolutely equal. I think that's what we're trying to do, or why I think people, equal rights, and what even the government is trying to do is make it equal. There becomes a point, though, where everyone has an equal opportunity to do something, but some people have more advantages to get that opportunity. Do you understand? Like, everyone has a shot at a particular job, but because a person grew up in an affluent household or whatever, has a better education, he's liable to get the job. And
liable. He will get the job.
He will get the job.
How can the black with a sixth grade education apply for a job with a law firm?
Oh, not at all. That's because, unless he had gone to law school, which obviously he didn't. I don't know. Getting into the race bit is kind of a touchy subject with me, because I did my term paper last year on that. And I think, I don't know if I want to even get this on tape.
Oh, well, don't say anything uncomfortable with.
Well, tell you what, be discriminatory about what I say when you put it on, if you do use this interview. Don't let anyone else see this. Well, I personally think, and I came up with lots of evidence in this term paper about how I think whites are the most discriminated against race right now in America. Well, actually, there are some smaller minorities that are like totally forgotten and are really discriminated against. But as a whole, I'm talking black versus white almost.
Yeah.
America is supposed to be equal opportunity. Now, let me give you two situations. There's a white individual who his parents are very, very poor or whatever, but he has decent grades. On the other hand, there's a black individual. Same exact situation. You know who's going to get the scholarship? It's going to be the black person. And there are, as a matter of fact, I'd say fully 20% of all scholarships existing now are minority specific. So it means I'm white, so I'm not eligible for the scholarship. That is racism against whites. It is, by definition. And I don't think it should be that way. I think it should be strictly financial need and strictly academic ability or athletic or whatever it is. I think instead of looking at someone black, you are black, you should get this or you shouldn't get this, it should be blind. I think everyone should be just the same color. I don't care what it is, but and then judge from there. I think I don't think it's because, and for example, in these downtown neighborhoods where, you know, it's predominantly black, I think that stems from long ago, the fact that they used to be slaves and that they were discriminated against. And now as it's growing, the way I see it is, why should I pay for what, let's say, my ancestors did? And my paper, I interviewed a lot of black individuals, and I posed that question to them. You know, do you agree, when you look at it objectively, that in a way whites are getting discriminated against, that it isn't fair? And every one of them said, yes, I think it is. But I think it's fair because we were discriminated against back when all the time. I go, oh, so do you think I should pay for what my ancestors did? You think I should suffer for something I had nothing to do about? And they go, well. And I think our government, instead of giving scholarships to these black people just because they're black, I think it should be concentrated on getting them the education that'll get them in. And, you know, giving them their financial need money, but concentrating on improving their base, their base education. Get them out of the slums. I mean,
do you think that's being done?
It is, but I think black leaders are putting too much pressure, or not necessarily equal rights leaders, are putting too much pressure on the government to give them immediate help as opposed to the gradual solid help. Now, if you give, let's say you give someone, give them a stereo, sure they'll like it, that'll be great. But I think a person that works for it will appreciate it more, correct? Fully, I'd say, let's see, what's the statistics? I can't remember the exact statistics, but I know for a fact more blacks graduated from college 10 years ago than there are now, and yet enrollment, black enrollment has increased by 30%. Now, what does that say to you? It says, I think, that people are getting allowed in that shouldn't be in certain institutions. You know, you only need, what, a 2.5 or 2.7 to get into U of M if you're black. And then they go, and because they can't handle it, because they don't have that base from high school, they, you know, they're failing out. And it's a waste of time and money for both him and for the government. But that's what black leaders are demanding. Well, they should get an equal opportunity to get in there. Because they haven't had their education, they should still have that opportunity. That I don't think that should be the case. I think it should concentrate on giving them the base education, which is long-term, but I think that's the only way this problem will be solved, is by improving school systems everywhere, by ensuring that equal opportunity. I think right now, if two guys were to walk into a McDonald's and apply for a job, a black and a white guy, I think they both have an equal chance. I think it's objective. I think racism is so much less blatant now than it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I think it's come a long way.
You have said, or referred to the importance of providing minority groups. No mm-hmm. reason we should restrict this to blacks.
Exactly. I just used
that. We could talk about rednecks and the Ozarks or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Puerto Ricans,
West
whatever.
Virginia.
Hispanics.
Providing them with an adequate base. Clearly, they don't have that adequate base.
Correct.
They don't have the decent grade schools, even. And those schools remain poor. Mm-hmm. So in the sense that you and I were privileged to go to decent high schools, grade schools, we were very privileged, in a way. Lucky, call it anything you want. But that is a fact. There is no way that I could ever compare the school that I went to on a grade school level with what the minority Hispanic or black has to contend with who grows up in Harlem or Watts or some section of Detroit. Would you disagree with that?
No, I agree that because where we were born, we are advantaged. I think equal opportunity still exists.
Doesn't it follow from this, though, that the mm-hmm. society we live in is at fault for not providing a more adequate base at that low level? There's something wrong. And this does not exist in all societies.
I agree. I believe it's the fault, not necessarily our society, but of our government. I think education is a priority. I think not necessarily mean university, but just the base. And the only reason why they're improving school systems now is because of the demand of the people. And when people aren't demanding that school systems be improved in certain areas, it's not getting done.
But it goes far beyond a simple question of whether or not the minority groups voice a loud protest.
Oh, also, I think...
You would agree with that?
I'm sorry.
You would agree with that? It goes beyond the question of whether or not the minority groups are voicing a loud protest. We can't say that the black base is in such poor shape because they haven't yelled loud enough.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I'm sorry if that's the way it came across. I find it difficult to believe that anyone that wants to get out of the ghetto can't. I think everyone, if they really wanted to, they could put in the effort. And I think the problem with that is they don't want to necessarily. That's the way they've grown up, and that's their society doesn't promote them to want more by working for it. Let me get
If you've been right, we get into the old question of what a free choice is and what the environment is. Mm-hmm. If from the if I have never grown up with a father who has supplied me with a decent role model, call it what you want, and I have never attended school full time, and I've had more fraternization with the junkies down in the corner. We just go down the long standard list of all of the evils of any ghetto. How can you then ask me whether it's possible, or why can't, how can you say to me, if you want to escape all this, you can? On some philosophic level, I can, I suppose.
That's the problem.
But I don't know how to, I don't even know how to answer that question, because I'm on my way down for the next crack fix.
Right, that's the problem. The whole idea we have to instill is, see, they can. I mean, if you look at, if they knew that they could break free and do whatever they want, be what they can be, they could. But the thing is, they don't know that, or what they do is they aspire to it, but don't know how to get that. And that's part of the base education. I think that's, you, if you let them know they can do whatever they want and show them how, show them the way, I mean, it'll happen on its own once you give them that. Once they give them...
But we're talking about education, we're talking about housing, we're talking about healthcare, we're talking about working on a group which has deteriorated for years. We're talking about generations of and billions of dollars of investment before we reap the benefits of any change. Okay.
I know for a fact.
You would agree with that?
No.
No?
Well, I would think, or I know, I could live better than most of those, or not most, but a lot of those people, on my own, by myself, working at a McDonald's. I know I could. I mean, I'd have to make sacrifices, but I could work better, and I would slowly move up and improve. And I think the big thing, this is getting maybe off the track, but it goes back to the immediate gratification of this society, too. I think they'd be more interested in having a brand new car than perhaps planning for their future of maybe financial stability.
Well,
as opposed to, I think, someone that has the base or that has that knowledge. I know I'd be more inclined to save my money in the long run so that I would do better than to immediately blow it on something that I know will only last a few years or something.
And yet one of the standard criticisms leveled at the current crop of college graduates is that they all want to come out of college, jump right into the $35,000 a year job, have their house and the two-car garage and the wife and the 2.7 kids all within a three-year period. So that is a criticism leveled at not the minority groups, but at the current crop of collegians.
Okay. Well, which direction do you want to go?
We can go either way.
Okay. I see that about the college. Yeah. But when it relates to the minority bit, well, because I'm not exactly in that mold of the college, but I am, because I do share some. Yes, I would like to. 3 years, hey, I'd love to have that $35,000. I'd love to have 2.7 kids, maybe a 1.5 dogs or whatever it is. But it's, to me, that alternative seems better than maybe owning one nice car and living in a lousy house or whatever, or just the ghetto mold as opposed to the successful mold or whatever. I don't know what you want to call it. I mean, I have difficulty understanding things. I consider myself somewhat open-minded, somewhat. I mean, I try to understand it, but because I've had these things implanted on me, I find it hard to believe, or I don't want to believe, that it's my fault that these people are where they are, when in fact, it really, what have I done to make it that way? You know, that, I think it all comes back to that.
It may not be your fault, but they certainly have not had the same opportunities. And the reasons that they have not had the same opportunities are numerous, which we could talk about
Night long. I understand.
And it's very easy for me to understand a minority group member who says, I haven't held down a job for longer than 18 months maximum. He may be 45 years old. My mother left me when I was 3. You just go down the standard list of all of the terrible things which have happened to this person. It says, and I'm a ninth grade dropout and never qualified for anything. If he then says, I'm going down to the corner for some crack or to get bombed out of my mind. It seems logical for me that he would want to do that. It seems illogical for me to assume that he would say, you know, I can really break away from all this if I just try.
I agree perfectly.
Yeah.
I think I finally understand now exactly what I'm talking about. Or I think I understand. Is place, it doesn't have to be a minority. I think I agree with exactly what you're saying, but it doesn't have to be a minority. It could be a white person there. What I think really does bother me, what the thing is two individuals, white and another, and a minority, exact same situations, the black or the minority, what have you, will have a better opportunity in this country. And I cannot see anyone denying that with evidence. I don't want it. My roommate, in fact, please don't put this anywhere,
no.
Okay? My roommate, in fact, is black. Mm-hmm. And same households. In fact, his parents, I think, made more money than mine. And he was given a scholarship. And my grades were better. Everything, I have to say, I'm a little bit, not jealous, but upset that I would be denied this opportunity on the grounds of my skin color. Because if I was another skin color, if I was a minority, mm-hmm. I would be eligible for this. And I don't see how that's fair.
Can you discuss a little your reaction, general reaction to the quality of the courses here, the professors, you can include in your comments if you've had any courses, for example, where you're sitting there with 300 kids and 5 TV monitors. I don't know whether you've had courses of that
type. I'm taking one now. I think, so far, all the classes I've taken, I think, have been excellent. I think right now I've got an economics class with over 700 students in it. And I don't have a problem. Anyone can raise their hand anytime they like and ask a question. I mean, it might seem impossible with a 700 lecture, but he's very personal. And I know I'm learning as much as I could in that class that I would with a 30 class. I know it. I've had both sides of it. And then on the other hand, I've got another class, my accounting class, that's on TV. That's in a 30-person lecture hall, but it's on TV. And you can't ask him questions, but you have teacher's assistants to do that for you. And that's a lot more impersonal. I think it's, if I wanted to do that, if I really wanted to learn that way, you can buy videotapes now, and I could be saving a lot of money. I really could, and I could take an advanced placement test and get the credit then, and I could save a lot of money, and I don't think that's the way I don't see how you're really going to get around it in a university this size, but I think that's really the only annoying lecture I've had or am having.
I said that I would give you a transcript of this, which I will. Mm-hmm. It'll be something that maybe you will pick up 10 years from now, reread, and maybe you'll see something which attracts your interest. What would you like to pick up and read 10 years from now? What would you like to remember as something that you said? I'm really asking you to project yourself in the future and look back in some strange way. What's really, can you sum up in a few words what's important to you on some philosophic level that you would like to read and then say, I'm glad I said that, or maybe I shouldn't have said that?
Actually, my views on this, the reverse discrimination bit, I think it might very well change in the future. And I might totally disagree with what I'm saying. But I think I'll be happy knowing that I said what I felt at the time. I think just about anything can be solved with communication. And I'm glad I wrote that term paper. I will never regret it. I'm glad that I said what I did on the tape, I think. And so I think I'll look back, even if my views are changed, I think I'll look fondly on what I said, even though it might be wrong, quote wrong, I don't know. And I want to see if I actually felt, if my goals, if I had gotten what I wanted, I suppose. 10 years from now, I wonder, will I live in New England? Will I have my 2.7 kids? Will I have a wife? And will I be exactly what I want to be? Which, it'd be kind of nice to see.
Well, we'll see. You have to call me in 10 years and tell me how it all turned out.
Sure, if you leave me an address. Here.